Egle Gerulaitit, better known as Egle on the Road, is a motorbike-addicted traveler. She already rode on and off-road through North and South America and Africa, but her last and most adventurous journey took her to Ukraine. It was a charity ride to raise funds for a four-wheel drive car for the army. So, listen carefully as Egle tells us how she rode from Spain to Ukraine with a Lithuanian passport, on a Japanese bike with a European insurance and an American license plate from Arizona.
Pegasus Reise. Expeditionen mit den Ohren.
Welcome to Pegaso Reise. My name is Claudio, and today I talk to Egle on the Road about a journey to the Ukraine. Welcome, Egle.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Egle, thank you that you took the time to talk with me. I'm really interested to know how it came that you had this crazy idea to make a journey on a motorbike to the Ukraine, what you've done on this journey, your fundraising idea, the 6 in 16 ride to Ukraine. Can you, for the beginning, explain in short words what was the idea behind 6 in 16 ride?
I think the main motivation was obviously supporting Ukraine, but I think I'm not alone in that, you know, you donate some money to this organization or that, or you help out in other ways. But I just felt like I needed to do something a little more substantial. But I'm not a millionaire. I'm not Elon Musk. I'm not anybody super influential. So I figured, well, what can I do that I'm actually good at? Or, well, I am under the illusion that I'm good at, that could somehow be part of the effort to help. And I realized, well, why not do the 6 in 16 ride? The idea was to cover 6 countries in 16 days. There's nothing super special about that. It was just had a nice ring to it. And because Lucy was in Malaga, Spain at the time, it just so happened that it was 6 countries, and I figured 16 days should be enough to do it. And the main goal was to document the journey, but also talk about the people, the NGO Kalo Kniga that I'm working with, who are purchasing and preparing those 4x4 vehicles for combat paramedics on the front lines. I wanted to talk about my Ukrainian friends. I just wanted to kind of keep Ukraine in the focus again, because the news cycles are so fast. We get tired of these things so fast, right? But unfortunately, that conflict is still very much ongoing. And so my goal was to both kind of keep the focus and fundraise for those 4x4s. But in addition to that, I really wanted to just meet riders and people on the road, because I believe we spend way too much time online and way less time out there riding and meeting each other. And so that was like the three-way plan of the whole trip.
Yeah, you already mentioned you made this trip with Lucy. And I think to understand a little bit more about you and your bike, I think you must tell the story. Who is Lucy? And how did this bike come to you, or you to the bike?
That's a good one. So Lucy is short for Lucifer. And the reason I named it that is because this was my first big motorcycle, and I was very intimidated by it at first. Later on, as we spent more time and miles together, it became Lucy. But at first it was Lucifer, because I was like, oh my God, this is huge. How am I gonna ride it? So I bought Lucy in Arizona in the States back in, I think, 2016, something like that. So almost 10 years ago, really, with my then ex-partner, Paul, and we set out to do the Trans-America Trail, which is essentially a network of off-road trails connecting coast to coast. So it was my first big bike and my first really long off-road journey, because even though I'd done some off-road in South America before, this was like 5,000 kilometers of it, almost, more or less. So it was kind of a big deal. And after we completed the Trans-America Trail, we sort of just kept going. My, you know, it's not a visa, it's this ESTA permit thing that you have to have as a foreigner when you go to the States. It expired in 3 months, so I had to spend 3 months in Canada to then be able to come back and continue down south to Mexico. So we snuck into Canada for a little bit, did Newfoundland and the Trans-Labrador Highway. That's where one of my favorite photos of Lucy is from. Lucy dangling off of a crane of a logging truck, because on the Trans-Labrador Highway, the battery just shattered completely and I was not going anywhere. And on that spot, there's like 500 kilometers of absolutely nothing. No people, no towns, no nothing. And this big truck stopped and he was like, well, I can give you a lift, and literally just like picked the bike up, put it on the platform. Yeah. Yeah, and then we just carried on. We went back into the States for a little bit, just kind of to cross it into Mexico. Rode around Mexico for quite some time. It's an amazing country. It's probably one of my favorite ones out there. Ended up in Guatemala for a little bit. And then Paul suggested that we actually, because the goal was to get to South America, but he suggested we skip Central America altogether and go to Cuba instead. So we loaded both of the DRs on a sailing yacht. Yacht is maybe, you know, it sounds luxurious. It wasn't that. It was just an old schooner owned by this hippie commune. And so we spent 2 months at sea.
The Stahlratte,
yeah, yes.
So many people have crazy stories with the Stahlratte.
Yeah, the legendary Stahlratte, absolutely. And it was, I think, one of their last journeys, because usually they would do Panama to Colombia. Mm-hmm. But before, they would sometimes do, I think, once or twice a year, they would leave from Mexico to Cuba. Yeah. Then you can unload the bikes, mm-hmm. ride Cuba for a few weeks. Yeah. Then you load the bikes again, then you go to, I think it's Jamaica, same thing. I think you get like a week there. And then Providencia, a few little islands in the Caribbean, and eventually Panama, San Blas, and Colombia, take the bikes out and carry on. So this was both mine and Lucy's first serious voyage, sea voyage, I mean. I had this vision of myself that I would totally just be like Pirates of the Caribbean and just like look fearlessly at the horizon. That was not the case. I get seasick very, very quickly, it turns out. But I'm really proud of the fact that Lucy started right back up in Cartagena, Colombia after 2 months at sea. There was no problem. That's one of the beautiful things about this bike, is that sometimes I call it a cucaracha, which is a cockroach, because you just cannot kill it. And I have tried, believe you me, many times. Not intentionally. But,
and even though that in 2016, this bike already was old. Né? It's really one of this classic one-cylinder air-cooled bikes, and seems to be very reliable.
Absolutely. I mean, I bought it secondhand. I was lucky enough that Paul, who used to build bikes for a living, so he went over everything. He changed quite a few bits and bobs on that bike, so it wasn't exactly stock. So I got lucky there. But yeah, it's true. A DR is so simple. Any mechanic in, I don't know, the middle of nowhere of Bolivia with a spoon and a little bit of wire will be able to fix most problems. And frankly, most of the problems that I had with this bike were caused by me, you know, so like a burnt clutch or things of that nature. So, yeah.
Okay. But now also you said it was your first off-road or longer off-road experience. And wow, seems to be very tough to buy a bike and go.
Well, I do.
To Cuba and North America and South America. Well, it's seems to be more than just a weekend trip.
Well, I got the riding bug back in South America with my little Chinese bike. And so after that, I spent a little bit of time in Europe just trying to find ways of how to kind of fund my lifestyle. But it just became a lifestyle rather than a trip. So I spent a little more than 10 years on the road in total, just living off of the bike. And yeah, it just kind of carried on and it evolved in all kinds of different ways, from chasing Rally Dakar to then deciding to try a rally and so on and so forth. So it's been a colorful decade, let's just put it that way.
Yes, yes. You've done so many, not only little off-road trips, but yeah, as you say, rallies and also Bosnia rally and many tough things. So it seems like that Lucy and you have grown together in this long time.
Very much so. And when I got the rally bug, which happened after chasing Rally Dakar in Peru in 2019, I shipped it from Chile to Europe. I did modify it a little more so that I got adjustable suspension, and which was an absolute game changer, I have to say. And what else? And a flat slide carb. I paid for it later with my sanity, but for rally purposes, that was another modification that made a big difference. Yeah.
Okay. And then you also in 2022 founded the, I think this was later, no? The Big Little Riders Tours.
Right. So I get back to Europe with the goal of trying a rally race, any rally race. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about anything. I didn't know how to read a road book. I had absolutely no clue. I just knew that it was something that I really wanted to try because Dakar just blew my mind. And I was like, let's do this. And I got an invitation from the organizers of the Hellas Rally Raid, which is a 7-day race in Greece. And I thought, yeah, let's go. Let's do it. And of course, as a sporting result, mine was absolutely miserable. I was last, like dead last most of the days. That bike was not meant for rally racing. And that rider was certainly not meant for rally racing either. But because it was such a fun and amazing experience, I figured I would keep trying and keep going. That's when the few modifications came along. And then at Hispania Rally, I got a loaner KTM 450. And then I actually moved from being, 102nd to like 92nd, which was amazing for me personally. And that's how I came up with, let's do something with the carb. Let's make the Suzuki more KTM-y. And when I said this to people, everybody laughed at me, except for Stefan Hessler, this German... absolute nutcase, but I say this with love because he's just obsessed with DRs. Like, he's got the original DR Big from Gaston Rayet from the original Dakar. So he's just like, he's an absolute maniac. And I asked him, can you make my DR a bit more KTM? He's like, no problem. I'm sending you a carb. Install that carb, you're good to go. And sure enough. But where I'm going with this is that I think it was 2019 when COVID hit. 2020, was it 2020? Something like that.
2020, yes.
Well, I was technically, I was technically homeless at the time because I was still just traveling along. I thought I would stay in Europe for a bit, race a bit more, then maybe go to North Africa. I didn't have like a concrete plan or anything. But then COVID comes along, I'm homeless. So a very good friend of mine, Jurga, said, you know what, just get home, just get back to Lithuania, you can stay at my house, this is going to get serious, just come back. So I did, and as everybody remembers, at first the lockdowns were pretty strict, so you're just at home, freaking out, what's going on, is it the end of the world? And then eventually you just get really, really bored, right? So I think when the lockdown started to ease a little bit, Jurgen and I started to sneak out on motorcycles. At first, we volunteered to deliver food to people because that was like a legal way to get out and help out a little bit. And then Jurgen had this idea, why don't we do like a fun enduro type weekend for women, just locally, just near our local town. I was like, sure. And Lithuania is quite small. There's 3 million people here. 6 of them ride, and maybe one of them is a female. I exaggerate, but you get the picture, right?
But I also remember that in the time of the lockdown, you also started to make video conferences with other female riders all around the world. So I saw that you are very active in that time.
Well, I was just going crazy. Like, I had cabin fever so badly. I mean, I was just used to keep moving and traveling and doing all these things. And now here I am stuck. So the video stuff was also to connect with other riders because so many people got stranded in Morocco or Argentina or wherever, right? Mm-hmm. So it's more like to connect and like, hey, what's going on where you are? How are you? And then it was more about that. But yeah, so we decided to organize that event, and we just put like a, you know, like a basic Facebook event, something like that. There was no promotion, there was no nothing. And so we expected maybe 5-6 girls to turn up and just have a little bit of fun on dirt bikes, and that would be it. Well, guess what? We got 110 participants.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, we have to rent a venue and a bunch of dirt bikes. And we realized, no, we have to do like 2 or 3 weekends because that's too many people. We can't do that. But in the end, like, we just had so much fun that Jurga was like, well, so how about we do that, but in Romania or Colombia or all these other places? Because I had contacts from the previous trips and stuff like that, and I freelanced a little bit as a tour guide in Ecuador previously. So it all sort of fell into place. We started with Europe, and then we started doing women's tours in, again, in Colombia, Mexico, Thailand, pretty much all over the world. So that became a life of its own in some ways. It's still ongoing. We still do a few trips here and there, even though people are a little more hesitant to travel these days. But yeah, it's still happening.
Yeah, great. So in all these times and all these trips and all these events, Lucy was with you.
Absolutely, because you know, I'm not a great writer. I'm quite mediocre, unfortunately, still. So what I really value when it comes to bikes is bikes just being quite forgiving, you know? And the DR, like, it's like, even if you make a mistake, chances are it'll just keep going. It'll just tractor along. Whereas like a two-stroke Husky, that will buck you off in no time if you make a mistake. So Lucy is not suitable for rally racing, absolutely not. But because it's so forgiving and I can just plod along, I actually finished all of them. It's also really reliable. And I think, you know, I'm also not great with things that have to, like, mechanical stuff. I still do not know how to adjust valves. I don't, and I probably never will. But because I spent so much time with Lucy and I've been all sorts of situations with that bike, I learned how to do the basics on it. I learned that if I crash really good and it takes me a couple of minutes to stand up and the bike is on the side for a little bit, then the airbox floods with petrol, so I know how to open it. And so just little things like that, I really, really got to know that bike so well. And it has forgiven me so many stupid decisions. And in the end, yeah, I think it became a lot more than a motorcycle. It's just like an old friend, a travel companion, and a home in some ways as well.
Yeah, a home for so many journeys. And so when we come back to this year, some months ago, Lucy, your bike was in Spain and you were in Lithuania at home? When you got
yes,
the idea
so that's,
of the ride?
That's another quick side story. So for the last couple of years, I ended up having a home base in Spain simply because we ran some tours in Spain with Jurga for women. It's Andalusia is a wonderful place to live. There's a lot of off-road riding, and I was just ready to have a little bit of stability in my life. So I ended up there. But this spring, due to all the crazy geopolitics, I decided that it was time to go back home and do my part, that is to join the Lithuanian Armed Forces as a volunteer, which meant that I had to just pack up and go, essentially. And I have this great friend, Paco, in Malaga, who stores bikes for people. And he said, don't worry about it, you can leave Lucy with me, and then you'll just fly down and come and pick it up at some point. So I ended up in Lithuania with my dogs and my two suitcases, and the bike was still in Malaga, and then I came up with the 616 ride.
Okay, but what I didn't know that you also joined the army in Lithuania. Was it perhaps also the ongoing war in Ukraine which made you come up with this idea?
I think it was several things, but one of the main ones was probably the realization that the geopolitics are changing not to the benefit of the West in some ways, when it comes to the American elections and things of that nature. NATO started to look a little bit shaky, and unfortunately, the Baltics are way too close to Russia, and there's quite a few assessments that if Ukraine doesn't hold, then we're kind of next on the menu. You know that saying, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So hopefully, of course, there's a lot of hope that it will not come to this, but it felt like a moment where we might need to stand alone again. And I felt like it was my turn to kind of do my part, because, you know, I've had a great run. I've had a lot of adventures. I'm very grateful for my Lithuanian Western passport that allowed me to do all of those things. I don't have children. So if it comes to it, it's time to go and do my part. And also because I started posting a little more about the Ukraine situation and things like that, I just thought to myself, how can I say, oh, Europe needs to help more or NATO needs to do this or that, if I personally am not going home to serve? Then I have no right to talk like that. So that was also a factor.
Yes. When I look back on 2022, when the full invasion of Russia and the Ukraine began, many things and many perspectives have changed. Also here in Germany, I think you also on your texts you write, you wrote also about traumas that many people, not individually but as a country, have. And I think for a long time in Europe we didn't listen very close to the Baltic states, which now looking back always said there is this big danger of Russia when it started the invasion in Ukraine 2016. It was Poland and the Baltic states who shouted out, and there were other countries like Germany, like our country, who said, oh no, it's not a big problem. We will deal with Russia. We will buy their gas and oil and so on. And I think it was shocking now with the full invasion in 2022 when many people realized that you were right. Yeah, Russia is a big danger. And it needs more than just diplomacy to prevent more bad things like that, what is happening now in the Ukraine. Do you have friends in the Ukraine?
Yes, absolutely, I do. I have some motorcycle friends, and now I have a lot more friends after these two trips. They're multiplying, so...
Yeah. But you also had before people who told you about the situation and gave you perhaps a little bit of the perspective, of the Ukrainian perspective?
Well, frankly, I mean, what you just said, we didn't necessarily need to be told about the situation much. I mean, ever since, to be honest, not even 2014, but going back to even the 90s with Chechnya, and then 2008 with Georgia, at that time, it was already crystal clear to... I think the Baltics, Poland, and Ukraine, what's coming. And I think the West had this really beautiful idea that if you just trade with Russia, then Russia will change, which is how we think. But unfortunately, that's not how they think. And so we are where we are. However, when the full-scale invasion began, my dad and I, we went to, because there was so much chaos, people tried to help, but there was not, you know, you didn't know what to do. So we just rented a big transporter van, loaded it up with like food and humanitarian aid, things like that, and had some contacts in Lviv. So we just went there to deliver what we could. I kept in touch with my Lviv friends. Of course, it's very different if you are in Lviv versus if you are in places like Kharkiv, and not to speak of places like Mariupol, right? So that's a little different. We kept in touch, and throughout those 3 years, yes, I would, like I said, I would donate, right, on a monthly basis or whatever. I kept in touch with my friends from Lithuania who helped out a lot more, like Aidas and Kelio Kniga, the organization that I work with now. But I think, yeah, the turning point for me was this February, March, the American elections, because then it just became crystal clear that we need to, I personally need to go back, do my part and help Ukraine as much as I can with everything that I've got.
And the best thing that you can do, as you said, is ride a motorbike and telling stories about your journey. So that became the idea, the project 6 and 16. So what was your plan?
So the plan, see, me and plans, like, I do have them, but typically they change, evolve, and I just sort of go with the flow because I turned 40 years old this year. And I realized, you know what, I'm going to just make peace with that fact. I'm going to stop fighting the fact that I make plans and then I do something else entirely. That's how I roll. That's fine. Let's just do that. So yes, I had a plan. I would do 6 countries in 16 days on Lucy the bike. I would go from Malaga to Lviv, Ukraine, meet my friends, and then ride back home and see how else I could help. And of course, the ride was meant to bring those stories into the focus and do the fundraiser for a 4x4 vehicle for Nastya, who is a 27-year-old combat paramedic currently serving right on the front lines somewhere east of Kramatorsk.
Yes, perhaps you can tell just a little bit more about Nastya, because she's also seems to be a very special person, a young soldier at the front lines.
Yes, it's still quite unbelievable to me how many Ukraine's youngest and brightest are in the hottest zones right now. So Nastya, she's 27. She is from Kharkiv, which is literally not even 40 kilometers from the Russian border. She joined the armed forces at the age of 19 as a paramedic. So she has been in this essentially since the beginning of the war, since 2014. Her husband, Kolya, who's 29, I believe, is also a paramedic, so they're serving together. They love animals. They love animals so much. Oh, my God. Like, Nastya has so many different stickers and chevrons and patches of capybaras. She's obsessed with capybaras. And her dream is to open a zoo animal rescue center in Kharkiv when the war is over. And if you take Nastya and Kolya, if you take the uniform off, they're just a beautiful young couple. If you put them in, I don't know, Copenhagen or Frankfurt or Vilnius or New York, they would fit right in. They're just young, beautiful people. Unfortunately, the circumstances are such that they are forced to do things and see things that I think no young person should see. And so the goal was to raise enough money to buy a fully equipped 4x4 for Nastya. I can talk a little bit about why 4x4, how it needs to be equipped. I don't know if those details matter, but so I'll try to keep it brief. There's quite a lot of factors at play, but essentially Kalokniga, once again, the organization I'm working with, they're focusing on 4x4 vehicles for the front lines, not just paramedics, the defenders as well. But the thing is that when you're quite close to what they call zone zero, to the positions, oftentimes, especially for evacuations, imagine you have to evacuate someone who's bleeding out. So you have maybe half an hour, maybe an hour, with provided they have a tourniquet on, right? That person needs to lie flat. So the car needs to be big enough in the back so that the person can be flat and somewhat stable. The car needs to be reliable and good enough to be able to drive through, because forget roads, you're under fire. So maybe you have to rip through a field, maybe you have to drive under shelling, whatever it is, so that car needs to be reliable. So that's why you can't just buy a 2,000 euro, you know, Kia, because you cannot put an injured person in a passenger seat of a Kia and that car would not even make it to the positions, right? So these cars need to be really sturdy, really reliable. And so, yes, they cost more because we also prepare them before going. The mechanics go over them to make sure that they're really good. And then there are certain elements like anti-drone systems that are really useful because, the drone war is escalated to something crazy right now. So there's a lot of elements that are not necessarily obvious at first. Like, quite a few people said, oh, I have an old 4x4 that I no longer use. Can I just donate that? Well, it's two doors. Doesn't work because if the driver gets shot, the others can't get out, right? So things like that, that as a civilian person, as just like, I love 4x4s. I love, you know, bikes, cars, everything. But I would never have imagined that things like that are important on the front lines. Now I know. now I know why and how. Mm-hmm. So that's why we focused on yes, the more expensive car, but the one that hopefully will serve for longer and hopefully help Nastya to save a lot of lives.
So such a car, you said, will cost more or less 10,000 euros, also second-hand, but equipped, good equipped car. And so you had the goal to raise 10,000 euros for such a car and bring it to Nastya, to bring it to Kharkiv.
Yes, that sort of evolved along the way as well. And just to be clear, the 10,000 is not just for the car, but once again, the equipment, the prep, and then the med kits. And also we try to stuff those cars with supplies, you know, pet food, like whatever it is. We try to bring them not empty, right, to help out as much as possible. And the idea to deliver that car to Nastya personally was because at some point I think it became personal to me. The more I talked to Nastya, the more I heard about her, the more I told people about Nastya, I realized, well, okay, if I'm going to raise that money, I got to deliver the car as well. And I think I also wanted to show people that, just for transparency's sake, that your money is going to go to this car that I will drive to the front line, so that people could see everything from zero to Kharkiv and beyond, and the moment that I actually hand the keys over to Nastya. So it was also to show, to hopefully earn people's trust as well, if that makes sense.
But your idea was to go to Malaga, to go to Spain, pick up Lucy and start the journey. So how was it? I think it must be a big difference to have this crazy idea. I think you're a person who, I have the imagination, has often crazy ideas about interesting journeys, travels, goals, and so on. But when you're there and the journey really starts, well, this is my experience. Then it's another feeling, not this enthusiastic feeling, but then the fear comes, and then you realize, oh, what was this for a crazy idea I had? Now I'm starting it really. I don't know how it is when you sat on Lucy after so much time and started to drive to Ukraine.
That's actually exactly where the trouble began, because, so before I left, I had Lucy serviced at one of the major dealerships in Malaga. I asked them to go over the bike, like top to bottom, fork, oil, brake, like the whole thing, just prepare it really well. That was before I even knew that I was going to do this Ukraine project. I just wanted that bike to be serviced, like in a really good condition, and just have it ready. Well, when I got there, it turned out that that major service that cost me something like 1,100 euros was done really, really badly. And luckily enough, and again, because I know my carb so well, when I rode out, I was like, something's up. It doesn't quite sound right. And at first I thought, it'll be fine. Maybe it's just like, you know, a little bit of old fuel or something. It'll be fine. But somehow I had this intuition that something's up. And so I called Paco again, and he's like, right, I have a friend who's very good with old bikes and Suzukis. You can go to him, to Antonio, and he can have a look. And sure enough, I get there, and Antonio goes like, oh, man, we have to strip this bike completely. I can already see so many things wrong on it. I'm like, oh, my God. Okay, so the journey is going to be delayed now. Like, what are we going to find here? All of those things. And unfortunately, we did find a lot of just really badly done work. Like, can you imagine my spark plug was hanging off and sparking off of the frame? Like, things like that. Yeah. And there were a lot, like, badly connected wires, the air hose not connected to the car properly. Like, we found so many things that were wrong with it.
Okay.
So that was day one. But I got lucky. Antonio helped me out a lot. And I also was really, really lucky with sponsors for this trip. So Enduristan was the main sponsor. I am so grateful to them, because not only they make great gear, but they're just really beautiful humans. They were very understanding. They helped me out. And so The trip got delayed. Then the next item on the agenda was, somehow it didn't occur to me that July is really hot in Spain. And by really hot, I mean heat waves. I mean 45 plus Celsius. So that was a little bit of a miscalculation, let's put it that way. But I got across Spain, and I remember I got to Cantabria, so it's already on the Atlantic coast, headed towards France. And that's, I think, this was maybe after 2 days or so, or 3 days, when it finally hit me what I'm actually doing. And then this emotional roller coaster began, like, oh my God, this feels like the last journey with Lucy. You know, and Cantabria has these beautiful, twisty roads, and I was just riding along and thinking, oh my God, I missed this so much because it's been so long since I rode just for me, not for tours, not for work, not for anything, just for me. At times I also felt guilty about it, that I'm enjoying this so much, because the goal was to help Ukraine and to keep that in focus. So how can I feel joy when there's that situation going on? And then I realized, well, actually, no, I'm very much allowed to feel joy, because that's what life is about, isn't it? So that was, in terms of actual difficulty, I mean, I was in Europe, right? Not Botswana, not, I don't know, Tajikistan or Bolivia. So it's easy enough. It's raining, you don't have your rain gear, you go to the Decathlon, you know, something happens, you call a mechanic, it's Europe. But on the emotional side of things, it was quite a roller coaster, I have to admit.
Yes, and you mentioned rain. I remember seeing what you are posting on the road. It was raining very much, and you thought, okay, it's going to be a trip in the hot summer of June in Spain. So let's put on light gear and you ended up needing some rain gear.
I did, and once again, like I said, most of my problems, bike related or not, are caused by me. I just overlook the most obvious things. I can cross all of South America alone, no problem. But packing rain gear for a Euro trip somehow, you know, just didn't occur to me. I was like, oh, well, you know, it's July, it's Europe, I'll be in Spain and France, like, it's gonna be fine. Maybe a little bit of rain, but I can handle a little bit of rain. Well, tell you what, a little bit of rain was 3 days of nonstop downpours all across France and most of Germany. So, yeah.
Okay. And you also had the idea of meeting people on the road. I don't know if that happened, but also to talk with other people in different countries, European countries, about their experience, about their traumas, about their relationship to what is happening now in Europe.
Yes, that, I think it was a good idea on paper to visit places like Guernica in Spain, a town that was completely bombed out just to terrorize civilian population, exactly what's happening in Ukraine right now. Or Oradour-sur-Glane in France, same thing, where a whole village was basically massacred. Again, same idea, to terrorize the civilians so that the country would give up. So I had this idea to visit these spots and hopefully meet local writers who would perhaps share the stories or talk a little bit about that. But for one, I think I probably started talking about that too late and people didn't quite have enough time to react. And also, I think for Europe, these wounds are there, but they're very old compared to my generation and the Baltics and certainly Ukrainians right now. So it's more like, oh, it's something that happened in the 20th century. You know, oh, it's something that maybe happened to my grandparents. No, it's not as vivid anymore, I guess. I suppose it depends where you go and who you talk to. So, but yeah, that didn't quite work out. But what did work out was, again, just completely unexpected things, like being invited to stay with people who then turns out know some Venezuelan guy who actually lives just 20 minutes from me right here in Lithuania. Or that German writer who saw me on the road, flagged me down, stopped me and said, hey, I don't do online stuff much, but I saw what you're doing. Here's 50 euros for the fundraiser. Good luck to you. So there were a lot of unexpected meetings that happened that I could not have planned for this, even if I tried. And so yeah, and then somebody else invited me to stay over and then helped out a little bit. So it just became this organic thing rather than something planned, you know, oh, on this day I'll be at this, I don't know, coffee place or whatever. No, it was just like, just along the way, people just helped out or wanted to ride together for a bit or just have a coffee, things like that. So,
yeah. Well, that's all about what adventure riding is, no? To have good plans, good ideas. And I think this was really a good idea, what you had to talk about the experience of the different nations, and but also on the other side, on the other hand, to be open to what really happens. And at the end, it's mostly the unexpected meetings on the roadside which are the most interesting and most best ones, who give you a new perspective or other perspectives or, yeah, new ideas. And so you went on. And how is it to ride into a country which is in war? Well, I know that in Western Ukraine, you don't see so much of it, but even though it must... I've never been in the Ukraine, which is a pity, not even in the peacetime and not now in this time. I really would like to one day, perhaps, I hopefully be able to ride there also. But how is it nowadays to cross the border? I think you went through Poland and then cross the border and to be inside Ukraine?
Well, first of all, if you're up for visiting Ukraine, there's going to be an enduro tour in the Carpathian Mountains led by yours truly at the end of August. I can tell you all about that a little later.
Okay, yeah.
But I want to pick up a little bit more on the people side because there was one more unexpected decision on this trip. And it hit me somewhere, I believe, in the Czech Republic, because I told you that I kept feeling that this is the last trip of Lucy and me together for some reason. And in Czech Republic, I realized why. I didn't want to go to Lviv and just take a selfie and leave. I wanted it to mean a little something more, perhaps, or maybe I wanted to add, because people were donating, the fundraiser was going really well, and I thought I want to do something just for me as well. So I decided to give Lucy away to Ukrainian defenders and my motorcycle friends from Lviv, Irene and Sasha. I talked to them and I said, hey, do you know of any you know, whether combat paramedics or soldiers or defenders, is anyone could use a motorcycle that's really reliable and, you know, good in all sorts of conditions. Within 2 hours, they put me in contact with Andre, who is this wonderful lawyer from Lviv and a dad of a little girl. He is now serving in the territorial defense as a drone and motorcycle riding coach. And so we started talking and I was like, could you use a DR650? He said, absolutely, that would be amazing because we could use this bike as a training bike in the polygon for drone pilots. And so that was it. I made that decision, but then my mind immediately went like, okay, so we went through everything back in Spain with Antonio, but I still want to make sure that the bike is really, really good. So I wanted to... you know, just have another look at everything just to make sure that I deliver a bike that's actually in good condition, right?
But the idea to give it, to leave it in the Ukraine for the army was not the idea at the beginning. It came on the journey.
Yes. Hey. Yeah, like I said, somewhere in Czech Republic.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So this feeling you had in the beginning, perhaps this is the last ride, was a right feeling.
Yeah, somehow it was. But it felt right. But again, because I wanted to make sure that I'm not giving away a bike that's, you know, gonna, I don't know, break down or not be reliable or whatever, I wanted to make sure that it's serviced again. And once again, people came in to help. So there's this wonderful couple, Joris and Agata. They're called ADV Hoppers, I believe. They're such fascinating people. I don't know if you had them on the podcast or not, but if not, oh my God, they have a lot of stories to tell.
Okay.
So Joris is, they're amazing. Joris is Belgian and he's got a small motorbike workshop in Krakow now in Poland. And I called him literally a day before I was due to arrive in Krakow and said, Joris, because he offered to help a little bit with the service beforehand, just if I needed anything. I thought maybe new tires, whatever. That's before the idea of gifting the bike. And I said, look, the plan has changed. I want to give this bike to Andre, who does these things. And I just want to make sure that it's in good condition. I don't have a lot of money, but can you help out? Like, just to go over it. And he's like, no problem. When can you get here? I'm like, tomorrow. He's like, fine. I'm here from 10 a.m. Let's go. So I got to Krakow, and then it became this big international operation because it was also Friday, right? So new brake pads. Agata went to Horastom shop to get brake pads. Mike, this American rider who now lives in Krakow, is like, right, what else do we need? Let's fix the seat. And so, like, it felt like all of Krakow just showed up to help out, and we worked on that bike until 10 p.m. or something, because Joris is very precise, you know. He's like, he was not happy with the seat cover. He's like, nah, there's a wrinkle here, that's not good. I'm like, Joris, it's 10 p.m. it's fine. He's like, no. So but it was also a wonderful evening, just, you know, talking to other riders and just hanging out and having that really wonderful evening. And then the next day I set off for Ukraine. The border is quite close from Krakow. I went through a small Krakowitz border. And that's, again, because everything happened last minute. Thankfully, Andre, he works with a Ukrainian NGO, because now the plan has changed, right? Now I'm not just traveling, coming back. I'm leaving the bike, which means, like, in terms of paperwork, what do? I can't just, you know, leave it and then get on a bus, because then I'll have to pay import taxes or whatever. So they prepared the paperwork, so I cleared the customs, and then I think the border took a little bit, simply because on the Polish side they're really, really strict, and my bike has Arizona number plates. My passport is Lithuanian and my insurance is European, right? So with officials it's always a little bit like, wait a minute, what is this? And then I think, I don't know, when after I, like, they checked all my papers, they were like, okay, you can go. And then another lady comes along and she's like, no, this is not right. I'm like, what's not right? She says, are you from Azerbaijan? I'm like, what? She says, well, it says AZ on your bike. What is this? I'm like, United States. She's like, what? America. Oh, so not Azerbaijan. No, I'm not from Azerbaijan. Yeah, so just things like that. And then on the Ukrainian side, it just takes a while, because you have to make sure that the customs are cleared in a certain way, because you're giving the vehicle away, right? And this was all new to me, so it took a little while. And so then when I finally crossed over, it was already getting a little bit dark. And I remember just standing there by the roadside on the Ukrainian side already, and just looking at these beautiful meadows and, you know, like the evening fog creeping along. It was a nice moment. And then Irene and Sasha came out to meet me. We went to Lviv. I spent a night at their place. Unfortunately, the night before, even Lviv was attacked by drones. So Sasha and Irene did not get much sleep. And the next day, they were quite tired and exhausted, naturally. It's interesting how quickly you get used to air raid sirens. At some point you stop noticing them, because even as a foreigner on your phone you get alerts, and it says, okay, either go to shelter or whatever it is. So you get immediately, before you even hear the sirens, you get an alert and it tells you what to do. And even in Lviv, that is now a reality, unfortunately. Yeah. It's just 70 kilometers from Poland, right?
So did this happen to you? Did you get the alarm and had to search for a shelter?
So I just kind of trusted Irene and Sasha, because, I mean, they've lived through this for 3 years, right? And they said that they can, you know, judging by what's happening, usually they just go into the bathroom, because that's like the strongest room, and just sit it out until they get the next alert that the danger is over. Or if it's a bad one, they go to the nearest shelter. But at this point, they said it's almost like a roll of the dice. You know, if it's mild, maybe we'll go to the bathroom. If something happens at night, we'll wake you up and we can go into the bathroom. But they said, you know, if it's a missile strike, the shelter probably won't help. So, and so I just kind of trusted them, because, you know, What do I know? And there are so many air raid alerts there, like this one at least every 2-3 hours. So are you going to be running to the shelter every time? Not really. And, you know, you kind of do what the locals do, I think. Mm. And once again, this is Lviv. Mm. This is 70 kilometers from the Polish border. Other than that, Lviv is a beautiful, beautiful city. It felt, some parts of it feel a little bit like Vienna. Some parts of it are, I don't know, it's just, it's a very old city, right? So you have these ancient Armenian monasteries, and you have the synagogues and the Orthodox churches. You have so much art. And it's just absolutely stunning. And, you know, we went out for lunch the next day, and it's just like anywhere else. You could be in Warsaw, you could be in Munich, you could be in, I don't know, in Toulouse. You're just having lunch. And then the air raid siren comes on. Or you're walking through this gorgeous old town and you realize that the statues look strange. And you realize that they're covered in sandbags to protect the art from attacks, right? So it's like this dual reality. There's normal life going on. Mm-hmm. Then the reminders are there. Or you see a lot of young men and women with prosthetic legs. And you immediately know why. So it's quite an intense experience, but Western Ukraine is still quite safe. So anyone wanting to visit, of course, it's a very individual thing, but it's still very much possible. The border crossing itself, especially if you're not clearing an Azerbaijani bike customs, it's quite easy. There's no issues. I think there's only one checkpoint going to Lviv, a military one, I mean, but there's no issues. The more dangerous parts and the more uncertain parts begin pretty much Kyiv and then, of course, east of Kyiv. Yeah. But Lviv and the surrounding areas, the outskirts, I mean, it's beautiful. Like the road that we took to get to Andriy to hand over the bike, it's just super scenic. You know, it's green rolling hills and little twisties. I got my one last little ride with Lucy. That was just beautiful country.
Hey. And then there came the moment when you gave Lucy away, but for a good purpose.
I hope so. I mean, Andriy keeps sending me videos of Lucy at work. Mm-hmm. So he's training new riders. So I keep getting updates, which is quite wonderful. And of course, I would love to help his unit some more. So that's why the Carpathian Tour idea. But the moment of handing the bike over, I was not sad at all about the bike. But it was quite hard to hide the tears just looking at these men and women who, once again, they're quite young. They're in their 40s. They're lawyers. They're artists. They're, you know, office workers that had to trade their suits for combat uniforms. Mm. Not because they ever wanted to, not because they like to shoot, not for any of those reasons, except that, like, they say that our children don't have to do this. Mm. So that was quite heartbreaking.
Yeah, and you also met Nastya.
Right, so after Lviv, I had to design a bus, train, bus sort of journey back home because all of a sudden I had no transport. And once again, actually, it's quite easy. There's overnight buses, very comfortable air-conditioned buses from Lviv to Warsaw to wherever you need to go. Or you can go to Lublin, which is the nearest airport in Poland, and fly out. So it's quite easy. I got back to Lithuania with my stinky boots and a duffel bag. And then I had just a few days to kind of regroup a little bit. And then we left for the front lines with the trucks that were already bought and equipped. And there wasn't just the Natya's car, but several others, because, of course, that organization works tirelessly to get these vehicles and those supplies. So I got back.
So that means that that on the way you fundraised all the 10,000 euros. So yeah,
yes.
The plan got right.
Yeah, the plan absolutely worked. In fact, I think we reached almost 14,000, which meant that we could add a bit towards another car and more supplies and more med kits and things like that. And of course, you know, the delivery itself costs as well, like from Lithuania to Kharkiv and beyond. That's a bit of a distance. Mm. It is fuel. You have to sleep somewhere, right? Yeah. Things like that. So yes, the fundraiser had gone really well. The cars were ready. Once again, I'm just beyond grateful to Enduristan for sticking with me. And another thing about them, because like I said, the idea to gift the bike came to me literally a couple of days before. I emailed them and said, look, you guys, change of plans. I decided to leave the bike in Lviv. Would you be okay if I leave the luggage on the bike as well? Because, you know, their Blizzard panniers, they're so lightweight, but quite sturdy and waterproof. I thought, I don't know, maybe Andrew can use that for, like, because they said sometimes they use bikes to run supplies to the position, like food or whatever, right? So I thought, well, those panniers might be useful. And Enduristan replied within like half an hour, absolutely do it. So that was amazing. But yeah, sorry, where was I going with this?
You went back to Lithuania, then again to Ukraine with a car. this was also something I didn't know really well. Are you still in Ukraine or coming back or going back? And then some days later, you were again in the Ukraine driving a car.
Yeah, it's all a bit of a blur, but like I said, you know, because I had the plan of 16 days, but 16 days became 20 because of the initial bike trouble and then this and that. So the window between me coming back and also buses and trains instead of riding back, right? So there's all this mess. And so initially I planned to have at least a week in Lithuania before we would leave for the front lines with the cars, but I ended up having maybe 2 days, maybe. Most of them were used for sleep. And yeah, and then we set out with the convoy.
All right. And then you said, no, it was not just one truck, it was many cars you transported, and yeah, you went together back to the Ukraine to hang them, to bring them to Nastya or to the people who are there where the cars are needed.
Yeah, so we delivered 4 cars in total. That's including the Nissan Navara that we got for Nastya. And then Aidas, who's the founder of that NGO, who has done probably 150 trips like that for the last 3 years, if not more. He was driving a van because there were several of us driving those cars. And so we needed that van to get back. Because, you know, a lot of the volunteers, a lot of people on his team, like I said, I'm just like, you know, I have my dogs, which were in the dog hotel, but people have families, they have kids, they have, you know, jobs and things like that. So the idea was to come back, excuse me, the idea was to come back quite quickly once we delivered the cars. So we had the van and the 4 cars, and we got to Kharkiv in 2 days. Yeah, 2 days.
So it sounds like a lot of driving per day.
Yes, that's putting it mildly. And there's also, you know, once again, a lot of moving parts to this. So now, not only we're delivering cars, but we are dropping some supplies off to some unit near Rybne, let's say. And we have to be mindful of the curfew hour, right? And then we link up with other volunteers who need help with something. And once again, we have to be mindful of so many different things. And then past Kyiv, we really had to stick with the convoy, like not to leave the convoy, not even for gas, not for coffee, not for anything. For the very simple reason that I just wanted everybody to get used to using walkie-talkies. Because, especially east of Poltava, I would say, the Russians are messing with signal so much that you open Google Maps and you are in, I don't know, Kharkiv, but it says that you are in Belgorod, Russia, right? Spoofing this, jamming. Okay. So you can't trust GPS anymore. And so, and I mean, as we passed Kyiv the night before, there was yet another horrible attack, right? So you have to pivot a lot. We were getting real-time updates from our Ukrainian friends, coordinators, volunteers, and even soldiers. The closer we got to the front, sometimes they would say, okay, you should pick that route or that route. Or I think in Kharkiv, when we're repacking the cars, because again, some supplies were meant for these paramedics, some supplies for some other unit and so on. The days are a bit blurred in my head, so I'm not sure if it was day one or coming back, but we got quite close to Kharkiv, and Sergei, who was our main fixer, said, okay, we need to stop and we need to give this a minute because this is a bad one. And usually when they strike the city center for maximum damage, right? So we just stayed on the outskirts for a little bit. And then he was like, right, okay, this one's headed for Sumi. It's okay, we can go. So there's quite a lot of that, that you have to kind of adapt and listen to the locals always and things like that. Or you learn things like always park the car facing the front. So if you need to move quickly, you just go. You don't turn around. You don't park it. You know. So it's little things like that that you never ever in a million years would think of, right? And then you just learn, and then they just become normal. Mm-hmm. Or the first hotel that we stayed at, not hotel, it was actually like a student campus type of place. I think I wrote about this in one of the posts, but in any European hotel, the first thing they give you is your room keys. And in places like Kharkiv, the first thing they show you is the shelter, right? Because Kharkiv is still being attacked quite a lot, unfortunately. But, you know, life goes on. A lot of the schools have been moved underground. A lot of the hospitals are underground. And people just keep rebuilding, cleaning up, sticking together, and just trying to live a normal life as much as possible, even under this constant threat. And
what a crazy reality you were facing there. And well, it's happening now, right in this moment where we are here talking together, and people are really in this situation that you are talking about. And yeah, that's so crazy to hear about this, but good that you went there you can just tell from your perspective how it is to be in a war zone.
Well, I mean, Kharkiv technically is in the war zone. It's a beautiful big city built in, I believe, the 17th century, right? It has nothing to do with any military targets of any kind. It's just civilian infrastructure that's being destroyed. But once you get east of Kramatorsk and you get something like 20 kilometers maybe to the actual front lines, then the picture changes quite a bit. But I think I could tell you so many stories that we would sit here, I don't know, for 2 days. So I just want to talk about the moment that we met Nastya.
Yes.
And the night that we spent probably the closest to the Zone Zero. So it was already a little bit late when we got there. And I mean, I saw Nastya's videos and I saw her photos, but when we actually got there, it was this little parking lot and she jumped out, oh my God, she's petite, she's so tiny, she doesn't even look 27, she just looks, I don't know, like a little bird. I call her the little bird, I gave her a nickname. And she was just a very smiley young lady with a lot of energy and jokes, and Ukrainians are so good with jokes, like humor, I think. In Ukraine, it's probably a bit of a coping mechanism, yes, but they're just nonstop. And so we just had a really lovely evening and a big, big hug because, honestly, I didn't really know what to say. Like, what do you say to a 27-year-old woman who spent most of her young days patching up horribly wounded soldiers? Like, what do you say coming from your comfortable place somewhere in the West, right? It's so I just went for a hug. And then we ended up in this little base. I was really hoping to talk with Nastya a little more and her husband Kolya as well. They're just really fascinating people. But that's when it really hit me. And because we were quite close, not only we would get alerts, but we could actually see the Shahids. There were quite a few explosions nearby to the point that the whole building was shaking. We could hear the artillery, I can never pronounce this correctly, responding. So it was quite close, but that wasn't what really hit me. What hit me was when Nastya said, oh, I would love to chat with you some more, but unfortunately me and Kolya, we got to go because it's going to be, I can tell it's going to be a busy night at work. And over there, you know what that means, right? Yes. And so we just, a few of us just kind of sat outside watching the so-called fireworks and just hoping that they would come back in the morning, you know? And they did, this time.
Okay. Oh my God, what a crazy story, yeah. But you met her. you were able to bring the cars there, and yeah, even perhaps it's just a little help, but it is a help, and it can make a difference. As you said, if somebody injured can be transported safely in this car, and perhaps at the end of the day it can save a life, that's worth it.
Not perhaps. I can tell you for a fact that it did, and it is right now. That's also why I have no intention to stop. I have joined Aidas and his team sort of permanently. I want to keep fundraising. I want to keep delivering those cars and those supplies, because they are literally life-saving. You know, it's not just a nice phrase. They are. And the other thing is that, unfortunately, sometimes they don't survive a lot. Sometimes you deliver a car and then within a month it's gone, because of a drone strike or a missile or whatever. Sometimes, and this is what I still struggle to understand, how Aidas is able to keep it together so well, is you deliver a car and supplies to a specific paramedic or soldier, and they're no longer there. So, you know, but Ukraine stands united. They are very tired. They are exhausted. So I think we shouldn't either, and so I will keep doing my best to help out. And in the meantime, there's also a little side project going on with bikes, because I want to get more bikes for Andre, because they're also useful. And the biggest thing I think I brought home from Ukraine, despite seeing bombed out towns and places and children's toys with landmines underneath them, because Russians leave nasty surprises like that for the locals. That's not what I remember most. What I remember most is the people and how strong they are, how resilient they are, how they are so together that I think we in the West forgot how to do that, how to really be a community, how to really stick together and help with everything that you've got and keep cracking jokes in the face of it all.
Yeah, and you said it, you want to come back, and you also said that you have a plan, a project in August.
Sorry, a plan project in...
In August, you said, a kind of rally or so in the Ukraine?
Well, maybe you can help me with that. So far, it's just an idea. But, so Andre's unit needs more bikes, right? So they need more bikes, for training, and they need more bikes. Like I said, sometimes they use it for scouting, or sometimes they use it for supply runs, things like that, because obviously bikes are lighter. You can go off-road, you can go places where cars can't go. So, as I was posting about Lucy and then the car trip in Ukraine and stuff like that, someone that I don't know on Instagram sent me a message saying, you know what, I got inspired by your story with gifting Lucy. I want to gift my bike to Andre's unit as well. I'm like, all right, let's meet. So we have, and I have a DRZ 400 that is currently being prepped, and it's going to Andre soon. And so then this guy, Thomas, and I, we met for a coffee to discuss the scheme, and we're like, well, hold on a minute. Surely we could put bikes, couldn't we? And so it's escalating now. So my idea was to just get people who have enduro bikes that they could part with. Maybe they don't use them as much anymore, or I don't know, or they would be happy to give away, to meet in Krakow at Yoris's place. We can service them if needed, things like that, and then ride to Lviv together. Maybe do a day or two around Lviv, because you have really great trails there, mountains. Sasha happy to be our guide for tour. And then in Lviv, we had the bikes over to Andre and his unit, and we'll take a bus home.
Hey, it sounds like a good... like a great idea. So if anybody who's listening now has perhaps a good bike or an old bike, but not too old in his garage, an enduro bike, who wants to donate it to Andre's unit in the Ukraine, yeah, perhaps that would be a nice event to come together in Krakow and then ride to the Ukraine to hand over the bikes for this good purpose.
Yeah, and to spend a day in Lviv to taste the local food, which is, by the way, amazing, to meet Sasha and Irene, who are wonderful people, to hang out a little bit, and to meet Andriy, who's also just a really brilliant character, and to get to know Ukraine a little bit, Ukraine and Ukrainians, while we still can.
Hey, sounds fantastic. Ukrainian food, what was the one you mostly liked when you were in Ukraine?
So I confess that I wasn't feeling very well, I think just because of the intensity of everything and the stress. So my stomach was a little bit off. So Irene got me this gorgeous mushroom soup with like fresh vegetables and things. It felt so good. It felt almost medicinal. They also do a lot of meat and potato dishes. Of course, you have the famous borscht, which is a beetroot soup. But yeah, like anything you order is bound to be absolutely gorgeous there. The food is just, I would go again just for the food. Seriously, it's it's that good.
Okay, there seem to be very much good reasons to go to Ukraine, to Lviv. Egle, thank you so much for for doing this project, this fundraising to tell us these stories, because this gives us an imagination what is going on in the Ukraine and what we can do, how we can help, and thank you so much for talking and sharing those amazing stories with us.
Thank you for having me here. And hey, maybe see you in Lviv. Bring an enduro bike, okay?
Yeah, okay. That would be so nice. We'll keep in touch and I will spread the word and let's see. Perhaps we see us again in Lviv. That would be nice.
Absolutely. Why not?
Okay. Egle, thank you very much. Slava Ukraini.
Heroem slava.
If you want to know more, or if you want to support Egle's Ride for Ukraine with a donation or an enduro bike or riding gear, then you find all informations on rideforukraine.com. If you want to meet Sonja and me, we will show a presentation about our adventure in Brazil at the event Motorradtage im Stöffelpark on Friday, the 29th of August 2025. Or if you want to meet us at a live podcast together with Howie from the Bearcast at Saturday, the 27th September 2025 at 2 o'clock at the Knülljause. All the details you find in the show notes or on pegasoreise.de.
Pegasoreise.de